Universität Hamburg.
Or if you found yourself in the German-speaking parts of the world, it would have been, ist der Mann ein Konkurrent Gottes, ein neuer Frankenstein? These are just some of the reactions prompted by the announcement that the geneticist Craig Venter and his team had managed to create synthetic life. If Frankenstein was not already mentioned in the heading of reports on Venter's research, this would usually be the case in the article itself, or in the user comments if we're looking at online newspapers or magazines, or in the letters to the editor in print media. Mentioning Frankenstein is a staple reference that seems to be a necessary ingredient of reports on new developments in biotechnology, along, of course, with Brave New World as soon as cloning or designer children are somehow envisaged. So news coverage of biotechnology is one realm where the fantastic surfaces regularly in everyday life, and this is what we heard yesterday in the opening panel. I think Ingrid Tomkomiak mentioned this in her statement. And this, of course, has been around for quite some time now. This is not a new phenomenon. John Turney, for example, in his book Frankenstein's Footsteps, Science, Genetics, and Popular Culture, which was published in 2003, or Valerie Hartone in her article Brave New World and the Discourses of Reproductive and Genetic Technologies, have shown that throughout the 20th century, mentioning Brave New World or Frankenstein in the context of biotechnological innovation has served as a shortcut to saying that something sounds like science fiction to us, or that something probably involves playing God and has the potential somewhere to run out of control. And the figure that comes up most often here is, of course, Dr. Frankenstein, who seems to be the ancestor of all mad scientists, somehow in the media coverage. The Irish Times, in an article titled, Has Our Mad Scientist Really Created a Frankenstein's Monster?, analyzed this phenomenon in connection with Venter, pointing out that, and I quote, the problem with all this is not just the linguistic cliché, it is the way a cliché of language shapes our understanding of an event. In the case of Venter's achievement, the Frankenstein image led to a gross exaggeration, both of the significance of what had been done and of the possible consequences of this alleged example of a scientist playing God. And remember, what Craig has claimed to have done was to build the genome of a bacterium from scratch, and then he incorporated into an already existing cell. So this is still somewhat away from creating a Frankenstein's monster. The article in the Irish Times further shows that, or mentions that Venter himself is partly responsible for the Frankenstein Association, for being associated with Frankenstein. And I quote, in 1999, outlining his plans to unlock the genetic code to the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Venter deliberately evoked Frankenstein. He said, Shelley would have loved this. And as Turney has observed, biomedical scientists in particular have become very conscious of the way their science may be seen in relation to stories of mad scientists and of the need to develop political strategies for dealing with this. And it seems that Craig Venter's approach is apparently to take the offensive here, but he modified this strategy in more recent statements where he made it clear that his team were not actually creating new life, but rather reassembling the pre-existing building blocks of life. At the bottom of this debate is the reality that images of scientists created in science fiction, and if we follow Brian Aldiss here and see Frankenstein as the first prototypical science fiction novel, so these images have the power to shape popular images of scientists and our perception of real scientists and of their work. Jose van Dyck, in her book Imagination, Popular Images of Genetics, published in 1998, generally starts from the assumption that there is reciprocity between cultural beliefs about science and the popular representation of the scientist. Gregory E. Pence, in Who's Afraid of Human Cloning, also published in 1998, more specifically points to the negative influence science fiction characters can have on the public image of scientists. Pence's basic opinion is shared by Faye J. Ringo, who argues that, I quote, the figure of the mad genetic experimenter has power to terrify scientists and lay people alike. And Brian Stableford argues that the advent of technologies like genetic engineering has helped sustain the routine demonization of scientists in film and horror stories. So there seems to be an affinity between the topic, the theme of biotechnology and the mad scientist on different levels, the mad scientist image. An example from Greg Bear's Blood Music, published in 1985, serves as a nice illustration of the complex interactions between science fiction, scientists, and the popular images that they gain. The protagonist of Blood Music, Virgil Ulam, emphasizes the baneful influence of the image of scientists as created in science fiction when he ponders how it actually obstructs his own work. And I quote, "How often had he wished that young Mary Shelley had never written her book?" I think this shows very well how paths can lead from the fantastic into the everyday and then back into the fantastic. Very long introduction, now I come to my contribution. I would like to add to this discussion by turning away from the media representations to some newer examples of science fiction dealing with biotechnology and examine how the geneticists are presented there now in fiction. I'm interested in how far these rather stereotypical images of scientists used in the media, ever and ever again, are renegotiated, redefined, or perpetuated in a selection of British new hard science fiction novels and, to bring in a German language angle, the novel Klonküsse, which was published in 2005 by the Austrian writer and neuropsychiatrist Constanze Denning. Daniel Dinello, in his book, not novel, Technophobia, Science Fiction Visions of Post-Human Technology, 2005, perceives the presentation of scientists, and especially geneticists, in contemporary science fiction as overwhelmingly negative. He concludes his chapter on engineered flesh with the following ideas, and I quote, "Anti-biotechnology themes in science fiction connect back to the whole history of anxiety with science, scientists, and technology. The science fiction geneticist joins a long procession of mad scientists who irresponsibly employ technology in a desire to conquer nature at any cost while rationalizing death, injury, and unforeseen disasters with pompous rhetoric about perfecting humanity." Unquote. The scientists are presented as overwhelmingly or exclusively negative in new science fiction texts is something that I do not really agree with, and definitely not fully agree with. In recent works of hard science fiction that deal with biotechnology and which I have dealt with more thoroughly and more extensively in my PhD thesis, the idea of the mad scientist is openly addressed. So the writers are, of course, aware of this image of the mad scientist as used in the media and of the literary heritage of mad scientists in science fiction. And I shall give just a few examples as representative to show how this literary heritage is explicitly mentioned and with the help of what strategies it has attempted to avoid such an exclusively negative presentation of geneticists in these newer texts. In Paul McCauley's White Devils, which is one of the texts referenced by Dinello, the radical anti-biotech mercenary Cody Corbin refers to Matthew Faber, who is the scientist who has helped to create the White Devils' very fierce creatures, and to his creatures as the mad old scientist and his monsters. Faber's former partner, a Dr. Lovegrave, says of himself, "When they write my obituary, they say I was a Frankenstein, that I made monsters." And when a scientist character inside a science fiction story says that, this of course creates an effect of irony somewhere, and it points the reader already to the use of this stereotypical image, I would argue. What is interesting here is to note that it is a fervent opponent of genetic engineering who calls Dr. Faber mad here, and that Dr. Lovegrave refers to himself as mad scientist only when he thinks about how others probably perceive him, which I would say emphasizes the idea that the stereotypical mad scientist Frankenstein image is rather a model somehow employed to grasp something bewildering and threatening more than an informed judgment, and is often made by those opposed to the advancements of biotechnology. And what I can probably add here, in all the texts that I've dealt with, there's never any objective or neutral narrator calling any of the scientists mad or judging any of their actions as bad. Further, those scientists who are perceived as mad by their environment, who maybe operate illegally or seem to be driven by dubious motives, are usually balanced by an array of scientists who work scrupulously and whose work is based on high scientific and ethical standards. For example, to come back to White Devils, Dr. Matthew Faber, the creator of these White Devils and also of the gentle people, very gentle creatures, he's balanced by his very sane and scrupulous daughter, Elspeth, who is also a scientist. Also, Dr. Faber tries to alleviate the charges that could be held against him by explaining his reasons for recreating an extinct species, pointing out that it was done not just in order to play God, and he emphasizes the ethically sound motifs for his research. I quote, "The point was that producing creatures with traits intermediate between humans and the rest of the primates would yield immensely useful ethical benefits. The ridiculous absolutist idea that humans are special, that they should be venerated because they possess some kind of special moral worth that distances them from the rest of the animal kingdom has been able to flourish only because the intermediates between modern humans and the common ancestor we share with chimpanzees and bonobos are conveniently dead. If we'd be able to finish our work, perhaps maybe then humans will realize that the gentle people aren't monstrous freaks spawned by perverted and misguided science." Now, this could, of course, be seen maybe as an example of what Dianello has termed the pompous rhetoric to justify the research and the experiments of the scientists. But seeing it in a less judgmental light, I would say that this justification shows that there's no fast condemnation of the apparently mad scientists on the grounds of these devastating outcomes of his experiments, because the scientist is given a voice. They can all give their own view and the motives are given, so at least the reader can think about there might be something in it. And this is generally the case with mad scientist characters in new hard science fiction. The same holds true, for example, for Conrad Hillier, the inventor of the artificial womb in Brian Stableford's Immortality series. Hillier is finally revealed to have spread the plague that has led to the sterility of humans intentionally in order to avoid overpopulation in a world that has invented successful longevity techniques, which sounds a lot like playing God, maybe. It is argued that Hillier did not simply act in order to be able to promote his invention, but with a long-range good for humanity in mind. One of his colleagues explains, "We never aimed to occupy the vacant throne of God. We just decided that we had to do our bit to help compensate for its vacancy." Which, however, one could argue betrays a contradictory impulse and therefore maybe doesn't fully serve the purpose of justifying the scientists' actions. Another of Hillier's colleagues points out, "What we did for the common good." When Hillier's latest plan, namely designing para-DNA and presenting it as an alien threat in order to unite humanity against a common enemy, is revealed, his colleague is quick to retort that Conrad's not mad. So though Frankenstein is not explicitly mentioned here, the stereotype of the mad scientist is still evoked and the scientists try to distance themselves from it. Whether or not this is fully successful can, of course, be debated. What is noticeable, though, is that characters are often distressed by the negative image that the public has of them and that they often strive to work against these images, not wanting to let themselves be reduced to stereotypes. A character in Stableford's Cassandra Complex, another installment of the Immortality series, points out that lone scientific genius making monsters in the basement is nothing more than a literary conceit. And this can be seen as an attempt to generically rework the stereotypical image of scientists on the one hand, and on the other as an effort to create an awareness for the multiplicity of science and attitudes towards science in general in order to work against an oversimplified, either demonized or glorified image of science and scientists in general and of geneticists in particular. What is further attempted in all the works of new hard science fiction that I have dealt with is the presentation of scientists as very human beings with a social life, with a family life, with many friends. So they are not reduced to their scientific profession, which I believe makes it harder to reduce them to inhumanity and to seeing them as mad. Now, to bring in an international and German language angle to this subject, I shall now have a brief look at Constanze Denning's novel Klonküsse, which means clone kisses or cloned kisses, which was published in 2005, and have just a very brief look at whether these strategies are also employed in her work, because they were all published at around the same time, at the beginning of the 21st century or end of the 20th. Denning's novel, which is set in 2043, deals with the geneticist Lise Meitner, who is in her 80s now, and with her daughter Sonja, who is really Lise's clone, so this comes out in the course of the novel. And their joint life work is the so-called Gender Life Project, whose aim it is to create human beings without any emotions. And Lisa and Sonja think that such creatures would lead to a world without aggression, without fights, without any arguments. In this novel, the scientists try to justify what they're doing, just as in the other novels that I've dealt with. And you alternately get the inside view of the mother and the daughter, so a first-person novel with two first-person narrators, basically. For example, we get the view of Lise Meitner on a failed cloning project that she had to abandon. I give you the German quote and then just sum up and give you an English translation. She says, "Ich konnte nicht verstehen, dass einem der Tod von 20 Versuchskindern so nahe gehen kann. Die waren doch gar keine registrierten Menschen, sondern eben eine Versuchsanordnung. Ich weine doch auch nicht irgendwelchen Labormäusen nach. So eine Charge Kinder ist auch nur ein Haufen Zellen, welche zufällig zu einem putzigen Gesichtchen zusammengefügt sind. Wie soll man etwas weiterbringen, wenn man sich da nicht abgrenzen kann?" So basically, I can't understand how you can be moved by the death of these experimental children. They weren't even registered humans, and this would be like crying for any experimental mice, which I don't, because this would mean that you invest any emotions in your research, and this cannot lead to anything. So though they try to present themselves as very rational, scientifically minded humans, somehow they emerge as rather callous and single-minded scientists in this novel. And though they do have family relationships and are presented in abortive love relationships, they are not balanced by any sane scientists. So there are other scientists in this novel, but they are somehow just as mad. They try to abandon the genetic research. They want to get away from genetic engineering and back to natural procreation, which has been abandoned by force. So there are no sane characters to somehow balance these very unscrupulous female geneticists. Also, the concept of the mad scientist, public image of the mad scientist, is not openly addressed in this novel. So I would say it lacks the element of self-reflexivity and the awareness that is found in the other novels of this mad scientist image, and how it is dealt with in the media is not present in this novel. Now, to conclude, I'm afraid that the question that was posed in my title, whether the scientist is still mad, cannot be answered straightforwardly. The question is also whether the scientist was ever mad. But I would say that addressing the stereotype, which exists when we have a look at magazines and the media in general, addressing the stereotype directly in a story leads at least to a differentiated presentation of scientists and creates an awareness that this is a stereotype, that it is a cultural cliché that is used and that might not be the most objective one. So considering the idea that representations of scientists in science fiction influence the public or popular images of scientists, it of course remains to be seen whether presentations of scientists in these new works of science fiction, where the image is explicitly addressed and somehow renegotiated, will influence the presentation of actual scientists and their achievements in the media, or whether the Frankenstein image, with its largely negative connotations, looms too large and is too deeply rooted in the collective public imagination to be overcome. Thank you.